Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
February 1st, 2019, and I think I have some really important news today, more so than usual, at least in regard to seeing the truth, even though many of you are likely well aware of this stuff because we've been talking about it on this show, and there's been many different levels of the same examples up until now. But this stuff is one of the first stories of today is very big in regard to Venezuela. Again, coming from Gray Zone, an excellent outlet, as well as something I think is incredibly damning that's going on in Israel that the media is not going to cover, but that's being called one of the largest land grabs in history or in regard to Israel, you know, in comparison to the original 1948 land grab of all of Palestine. We have some interesting contradictions happening between the way Congress is addressing Yemen again in regard to the War Powers Act that they're somehow against, but the contradictions therein in regard to Venezuela, and then contradictions in regard to their actions towards Yemen, but then wanting to stay in Syria and Afghanistan, doesn't add up. There's a lot of contradictions flying around today, as usual, but let's get into it. For the first story, something that I want to cover as a follow-up that we actually just talked about, that I saw a tweet from Dabu, and which he does excellent work, and now we're actually seeing this confirmed. And it gets even more ridiculous when you realize what they said at the bottom of this little blog post that says, oh, by the way, we're censoring people that talk about Venezuela that go against the establishment narrative, exactly like we talked about yesterday. Coming from Zero Hedge, Twitter bans 2,000 pro-Maduro accounts as demands for regime change escalate. So this is indeed absolutely happening, which I'm sure many were not shocked to find out. This is something that happens all the time, happening to independent media. And this story gets a little more ridiculous when you find out what they said at the bottom of this little blog post. So Twitter said in their own blog post that it removed 2,000 accounts located in Venezuela, which it deemed to appear to be engaged in state-backed influence campaigns targeting domestic audiences. Now, the company also went on to say, much later and way at the bottom, quote, we are unable to definitively tie the accounts located in Venezuela to information operations of a foreign government against our country. That's interesting. You might think that would be the first thing they would say. Guess what? We can't prove any of this, which is absolutely ridiculous. Basically, as we continue to show you, they are shutting down people talking about what's really going on in Venezuela. Anyone that's not in lockstep about the regime change of Venezuela for the people is getting shut down. You know, all those hundreds of thousands and more of pro-Maduro people that do exist in that country are just deemed foreign agents because they don't go along with the establishment narrative. This is the reality of what's going on today in this country as well in regard to independent media, as we did a whole show about yesterday, which I recommend you go check out. Now, as Ben Norton added, this comes after Twitter suspended Venezuelan government accounts 1.5 years ago. So they just suspended Venezuela itself, showing you what they're trying to shut down on Twitter. Now, social media corporations act as an extension of U.S. government interests, he says, which is absolutely true and something we all need to come to terms with and make sure that we broaden our horizons when it comes to social media, if not just get rid of it altogether, personally. But that is such an important thing to follow up on to see that this is really happening. Now, this story, what I would consider the first story of the day, something that I think is absolutely important, that I think, it's crazy enough, people will still just disregard because it doesn't align with what they want to believe. This is what we have been talking about, at least one of the things. I've been referencing multiple documents that I've seen in the past, as well as just Pompeo himself saying that if you want your people to eat, you better follow what we have to say, speaking to Iran. But we have seen countless times where they have literally outlined that sanctions are designed to attack the people of a country, drive them to desperation so that they revolt on their leader. Not because they're against the leader necessarily, but because they just want to stop starving to death. And it's because of these actions. As multiple people in recent months have said, the former UN expert that said exactly the same thing, Weizenbrod, who said the exact same thing. Now, this document shows you, and this is what I've been talking about, at least one of them, that this is the outlined plan, economic warfare. You know, not we need to fight for the people and we're backing this guy who's the legitimate president, but we have planned this, put it into motion, carried out this economic attack on the country, orchestrated its downfall in order to benefit from it. This is the plan. Coming from Gray Zone, internal U.S. government document outlines program of economic warfare on Venezuela. Now, this is all in here for you to look at yourself, included in the show notes. Documentation. Now, if you can ignore this kind of stuff, then I think there's bigger problems that you may be dealing with. But they're the documentation, I mean. Read it for yourself. And it shows you that this has been a long time coming, that they do this to country after country, using economic warfare to bring it to its knees, point to it as a problem, and say, oh, look at how bad that country is. Looks like they need some democracy. And then take the resources. Now, with the coup raging in Venezuela, WikiLeaks published an excerpt from what it described as the U.S. coup manual called the Army Special Operations Forces Unconventional Warfare Booklet, with a link to the PDF in the show notes, or in the link in this article in the show notes, which you can check out for yourself. Now, WikiLeaks themselves, how love them, hate them, Assange, love them or hate them, the information they have released thus far has not once, a single fact, been shown to be false. So bear that in mind. Here's the tweet that they shared talking about this and sharing an excerpt from the larger concept. Now, WikiLeaks drew particular attention to this segment of the publication entitled Financial Instrument of U.S. National Power and Unconventional Warfare. This section outlines how the U.S. government, in its own words, uses, quote, financial weapons to wage economic warfare against foreign governments that try to pursue an independent path. An independent path, not a socialist path, not a dangerous path, but an independent path, something other than U.S. interests. Very big deal to think about what that means. Someone that doesn't bend the knee to what they think is most important. Now, in the Unconventional Warfare Manual, Army Special Operations Forces, ARSOF, wrote that the U.S., quote, can use financial power as a weapon in times of conflict up to and including large-scale general war. And it noted that, quote, manipulation of U.S. financial strength can leverage the policies and cooperation of state governments. That is to say, forces those governments to comply with the U.S. policy. Now, we talked about them flooding the market to manipulate the oil prices and then using sanctions to stop Venezuela from being able to get loans. This is what they're talking about. Part of, anyway. Now, institutions that help the U.S. government accomplish this, according to ARSOF, which, again, was Army Special Operations Forces, are, guess who? The World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. You know, these groups that are impartial, apparently, but yet they're working in tandem with the government to carry these things out. ARSOF stated examples of, quote, financial weapons include, quote, state manipulation of tax and interest rates. I'll say that again. Financial weapons include state manipulation of tax and interest rates. You know, inflation and pressure on financial institutions to restrict, quote, loans, grants, or other financial assistance to foreign state and non-state actors. This is what they do. Orchestrate the downfall and then stop them from being able to do anything that can drive, that pull them out of the hole. This is why they also attack their cryptocurrency. This is a modern adaptation to this, stopping them from fighting back financially to actually help the people in their country that are suffering, and then blame it all on the country itself, or rather the leader that they want to depose. Goes on to say, quote, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, has a long history of conducting economic warfare valuable to any ARSOF UW campaign. This is according to the manual. Now, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control is what oversees sanctions against countries like Venezuela. This is the group we're talking about. And on January 28th, the day that WikiLeaks tweeted this excerpt, OFAC sanctioned Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA. Just right in line with everything that's being outlined. Now, the goal of these latest U.S. sanctions is clear. Steve Mnuchin, Trump's Treasury Secretary and the former Chief Information Officer for Goldman Sachs, indicated that Venezuela's U.S.-backed coup leader, Juan Guaido, will use PDVSA and Venezuela's U.S.-based oil assets to bankroll his unelected parallel government. In other words, to fund his revolution. Now, I didn't play this before, but I just could not play this clip right here, understanding that they literally just said, we're going to now take the oil of this country and we're going to give some of it to the rebel leader to fund their revolution. Well, let's ask ourselves where the rest of that oil is going to go. Well, I'll give you one guess. Every time. I want to play this, so hold on. Interesting how it just loves to freeze up right at the best moments.
The fact is, what we should have done is we should have asked the rebels when they came to it. We should have said, we'll help you, but we want 50% of your oil. They would have absolutely said, okay, 100%. In fact, they would have said, how about 75%? So they came to us. They were nothing. They were gone. The war was over. He was taking over. Then all of a sudden, we go in through NATO, which is funded by us largely, and which is largely our weapons and our guys. We go in and absolutely decimate this guy. They take over, and now you ask for oil? And isn't it sad? We could have had anything we wanted. We could have had 50% of those oil fields. You know, in the old days when you had a war, it's to the victor belong the spoils.
Now, he has said this on numerous occasions, double down on the same exact thing. We should just tell them that we're going to work with the opposition, not because they're good, not because we support what they're trying to do, but just because we'll support them and say we'll take half of your oil to do it. You know, the victor goes the spoils, just straight up war for profit. This is what we're talking about. And you could argue, oh, it's different now. He said that was before, but he said this countless times up until very recently. He's talking about Libya, right? We should have just, Libya, that's now a completely failed state, running an open slave market, selling the Libyans they pretended they were going to protect. But none of that matters, right? We should have just taken their oil and it all would have been okay. Really unbelievable. And understand that this is what we're talking about now that they just took the oil assets. Because they're pretending, oh, we need to keep it out of the hands of that evil dictator. But then they gave half of it, probably, like he's saying. I mean, clearly they just said that they're funding the revolution. But I can promise you that they are taking, and in my opinion, I should make sure and say, that they are taking some of this oil and profit for themselves because that is what the point is. Now, they're using this money to fund this revolution, as they said themselves. But they don't call it a revolution. However, he's the new democratically, undemocratically elected leader. Now, Guaido, of course, as we pointed out before, immediately upon being sworn in by himself, targeted PDVSA within hours of having this declared, the interim president himself saying, I am now the president. And now we're going to be targeting oil companies and, you know, giving it to the United States. Of course, with Trump's blessing, as we've shown. Because remember, we had the phone call prior to this where Pence spoke to them on the phone and said, you do this, you overthrow this, and we'll be behind you. And then this has all been orchestrated and it's all verified. Now, Guaido and the U.S.-backed opposition hope to restructure PDVSA and move toward privatization and rewrite Venezuela's hydrocarbon laws and handing out contracts to allow multinational corporations access to the largest oil reserves on the planet. This is exactly what we were talking about. Now, Guaido has sought financial assistance from, guess who? The International Monetary Fund, which Arsof identified as the U.S. ally in its economic warfare strategy. All the pieces fall into place. Now, the Arsof Unconventional Warfare Manual we just talked about makes it clear that these policies are not just a peaceful pressure campaign. They are a part of an explicit strategy of unconventional warfare aimed at Venezuela. Now, please, I again recommend you read this all for yourself. The manual, the WikiLeaks information, all of it. Now, these words, straight from the mouth of the U.S. government, confirm that sanctions and other punitive economic policies are not mere preludes to war, as they try to claim, or not even war at all. They are a form of war. As Ron Paul has always said, sanctions are an act of war. And now, by their own words, typical contradictions, as they always do, it shows you that they also think that they're acts of war. Now, the United States is not considering a war against Venezuela. The superpower has already been waging a war for years, if not decades, on Venezuela. hopefully we're beginning to recognize what's really going on. Now, something that was recently shared with me that just adds to this point from even further back, showing you this has been going on likely as long as they've been doing regime changes and coups around the world. In 1970, in a meeting with President Richard Nixon on how, specifically, how to undermine the democratically elected Chilean government of Salvador Allende, which we've talked about, one of the many coups in their record of devastated countries, CIA Director Richard Helms wrote, quote, "Make the economy burn." In addition, a top U.S. representative openly admits that the same strategy is being applied in Venezuela. Former U.S. Secretary of State Eagleburg said on Fox News that Chavez's appeal to the Venezuelan people only works so long as the populace of Venezuela sees some ability for a better standard of living. Yeah, can't give them hope for a future, can we? He goes on to say, if at some point the economy gets really bad, Chavez's popularity within the country will certainly decrease. And it's the one weapon we have against him to begin with and which we should be using, he says. Now understand that they're talking about, this is what we say, that it's not about whether they support him or not. It's about driving them to a desperate position where they don't care who's in charge. That's what he's talking about. Now, he goes on to say, namely, the economic tools of trying to make the economy even worse so that his appeal in the country and the region goes down. Anything we can do to make their economy more difficult for them at this moment is a good thing. But let's do it in ways that do not get us into direct conflict with Venezuela if we can get away with it. That is a direct quote from the Secretary of State. Think about that during the time of Chavez, but understand that this has been going on forever. Now, what also baffles me is this stuff is all out there. It's not that hard to find this stuff, but so many people refuse to do their due diligence and see what's really going on. It's just unbelievable to me. The absurdity that you could think these people actually care about other civilians in other countries with what they're doing here and what they're doing everywhere else, and with this exact information showing you that this is all orchestrated, knowing that it will hurt those people, is absolutely staggering. Now, in addition to all of this orchestrated economic chaos for the benefit of the U.S. oligarchs, there's a new update on what, you know, the wonderful John Bolton has to say. We now have Bolton openly threatening to send Maduro to Guantanamo torture prison if he continues to stand in the way of U.S. plans. Bolton mockingly stated on Friday that President Nicolas Maduro could find himself locked away in a U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba if he does not soon step aside. Bolton, who has repeatedly threatened U.S. military action to force out Maduro, as well as many other countries around the world, made the threat in a radio interview with commentator Hugh Hewitt. Now, he essentially was, they were discussing previous leaders that were exiled and talking about the relation to Maduro. And then basically said, oh, Maduro should just take the amnesty being offered and go find himself on a comfortable beach somewhere, or he might find himself on a different beach in Guantanamo. Ridiculous. This man is by far one of the worst people I have ever come across in regard to politics. And that's hard to say. There's a lot of them. Now we have Elliot Abrams in the mix. These people are villains in my mind, knowingly allowing the destruction of countries and the murder of populaces because they want to achieve a goal. And now he's openly saying this like a laughing talking point. Yeah, we'll just send him to Guantanamo. All right, Guantanamo is a good thing now, apparently, even though we recognize that it's a completely illegitimate, illegal institution where it's a black site, or it used to be before we didn't even know about it. It's a black site area. They can do things off U.S. soil to circumvent U.S. law. Wonderful people, these people. Now, in the last story related to Venezuela, coming from Venezuela analysis, during all of this, Maduro has been trying to hold talks, trying to have some kind of, you know, actual political discourse to do things that, you know, to stop the economic chaos, essentially. And now we're finding out that the U.S. is just saying, we don't care what you have to say, we don't want to talk at all, while pressuring other people as well, which is interesting. Now you can see the article entitled, Venezuela, U.S. rejects calls for dialogue ahead of dueling marches. Now on Wednesday, the governments of Mexico and Uruguay announced an international conference set to take place in Montevideo on February 7th. Now, according to a joint statement by both countries, the goal of the conference is to, quote, establish a new dialogue mechanism that will contribute to peace and stability in Venezuela. Oh, God forbid. God forbid we want peace and stability in Venezuela. It doesn't matter about peace and stability. It only matters they get what they want. That, as far as the U.S. side of this, in this equation, right? It's about accomplishing their goal, as we just outlined in all their information. Now, a report in El País, I believe it's a Spanish news outlet, on Friday contained stark revelations regarding U.S. influence over Spain's Venezuela policy. Now, according to the paper, the Trump administration pressured Spain not to move forward with dialogue initiatives and alerted Madrid of Guaido's self-proclamation in advance. Of course, again, showing you that they knew this was all coming. They told them ahead of time, oh, don't do it. Don't do anything because we're going to have a new president soon because we're completely involved in this. Now, Spanish Foreign Minister Josep Borrell said in reference to the latest dialogue initiative, you know, there's the potential peace de-escalation with Venezuela. He said, quote, "We are under a lot of pressure. I'm not going to tell you from whom, but you can imagine we're under a lot of pressure to vote against the creation of this dialogue group." Take a wild guess who's pressuring him not to talk with another leader about de-escalating a very dangerous and very chaotic situation for the people of Venezuela. Take a guess. Now, the U.S. has rejected a new initiative by Uruguay and Mexico to restart dialogue in a bid to de-escalate the political standoff in Venezuela. I rejected it. Interestingly, the same way they reject discussions about the INF treaty with Russia, which I was going to talk about today, but I had a lot going on here that I wanted to make this not as long as usual today. That they just don't want to talk. No, we don't want to come inspect your missiles. We already made up our mind that you're lying, so we're not going to look. This is the absurd nature of this. This is what even with enemies, there used to be a point where you would have dialogue. And now they just say, nope, we already made up our mind. We have a new president. We picked him. We don't want to talk to you. You need to leave or we're going to throw you in prison. Wonderful, wonderful things that are happening today. Now on to the next story that relates in an interesting way to all of this, but more so about our Congress and what's going on in Yemen. But I want to point out some very, very interesting hypocrisies in regard to this, in regard to Venezuela as well. Now this is coming from antiwar.com. Congress launches new bipartisan effort to end U.S. role in Yemen war, which in general is a good thing. Absolutely. Trying to initiate the War Powers Act again to challenge the illegal war, one of them, that's going on in Yemen. This is a good thing, but the problem is, as I pointed out before, the loopholes within the War Powers, the bill they're putting forward in general, which I won't rehash again, but the whole thing is very half-hearted in my mind. But there's more about this that I want to point out. This is an interesting development. Now, on Wednesday, a bipartisan coalition of lawmakers from both sides, from the House and the Senate, from both sides of the aisle, announced their intention to reintroduce the War Powers Act challenge to the U.S. participation in the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war in Yemen. Now, the war was never authorized by Congress, as really none of them have been, and the challenge would require the administration to end U.S. involvement, which I don't think is actually inaccurate, because all they'd have to do is say, well, we're targeting al-Qaeda now, so we're allowed to, which the bill outlines, and they could also carry out drone bombings, which the bill doesn't stop. Kind of a half-hearted thing, but any step in the right direction is good. Now, the Yemen war was initially launched by the Saudis to oust a Shiite faction and reinstall former President Hadi, who is a U.S. and U.N.-backed vote, in a U.S. and U.N.-backed vote, won an election, guess what, with no opposition in early 2012, to a two-year term as president. Now, the term has long since expired. However, the Saudis maintain that he's still legitimate as the ruler. Now, think of this in regard to Venezuela. A U.S.-backed person who ran with no opposition, like they're saying over here, which is actually not even true about Maduro, and then who stayed longer than his 2 years, and they just said, ah, screw it, we're still here, we're still in charge, we're still legitimate because the U.S. says we are. Think about the hypocrisy here. How absurd it is that they can back someone like this. In addition, the Hadi administration has at least four people that are currently on the U.S. Treasury list for sponsors of terrorism. That's called hypocrisy. But they don't think you're smart enough to look this stuff up for yourselves. I've talked about this countless times. But the reality here is that they're backing someone just as illegitimate in Yemen that they want you to think Maduro is illegitimate in Venezuela. The hypocrisy makes my head spin. Now, after years of trying to reinstall Hadi, Of course, we've seen soaring civilian death tolls and an estimated 20 million people facing starvation. And many lawmakers are reluctant to pass to keep the U.S. seal of approval on this war, which is, I would say, largely because of what we're doing, because of what you're doing, forcing the constituents of all these senators to speak up and say, hey, how the hell are you supporting this? So they're feeling pressure. That's my opinion. Now, in December, the Senate passed the War Powers Act challenge against the war. But then the leadership of the House and the Senate, interestingly enough, they prevented a vote on the matter, forcing them to start over with this new Congress. And we've talked about this. Both the Manage Our Wolves Act and the Farm Bill literally stopped this bill in its tracks secretly. Think of that. A bill about wolves and a bill about farming and other many other things were snuck in about Yemen. Why do you think they did that? Anyway, the point is that now with the new Congress, they're going to try it again. Now, President Trump, of course, has threatened to veto any bill calling for an end to the war. Interesting, while currently, feigning to want to pull out of Syria, saying that, well, we're not going to end this war in Yemen. If you bring up anything about it, I'm going to veto it. Which, in and of itself, is actually incredibly absurd. You know, in my opinion, showing the absolutely faulty nature of the War Powers Act in another way. Which is an act that's explicitly about Congress blocking presidents from launching unauthorized wars. Funny how it's not been brought up all these countless times before, but why have an act that it's designed to challenge unauthorized actions of the executive branch if it can simply be vetoed by the executive branch? Just think about that for a moment. Now, there's the further step that it can come back to Congress for a two-thirds vote, which ultimately rarely happens. The reality is that this was meant to be this way. I think, in my opinion, it's meant to give the illusion of some kind of congressional movement, when in reality, it's all meant to maintain the same status quo. And that's what's so sad. But it draws attention to what's going on in Yemen, and that's a good thing. But the hypocrisies and the contradictions in regard to Venezuela and so many other places and what they're saying here has to wake some people up. It's crazy to see. Currently, like we said, well, we have 20 million people starving in Yemen. But I'm sure they care about those starving Venezuelans. Now, moving on to a related story that actually is pretty amazing to me. I couldn't believe the overt nature of this, how our Congress is coming right out and saying, and being very clear about the fact that they just want perpetual war. Coming from anti-media, Senate vote opposes ending U.S. wars in Syria and Afghanistan. Pretty right in your face, too. And it's a non-binding resolution, but it's important to show you that they're taking steps to basically say, we don't want to end these wars. And that should be alarming for many reasons. Now, on Thursday, the Senate voted 68-23. To pass a resolution expressing opposition to President Trump's plan to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria and expressing opposition to any theoretical pullout from Afghanistan that might result from a negotiated deal to end that war with the Taliban. Interestingly enough. Funny, just in case you ever want to end that Afghanistan war that's been going on for 17 years, we're going to include that we don't want you to, basically. And, negotiating with the very group that was supposedly the goal to get rid of in the beginning. But, now they're making deals with them and maintaining the war. Now, it's a non-binding resolution, as I said, and it was passed with overwhelming support from the Republican majority, setting them squarely against parts of President Trump's foreign policy. Also, a number of Democrats who voted against it expressed concern that it was tantamount to a vote advocating a state of permanent war, which it realistically is. In 2001, authorization for the Afghan war was completely built around 9/11. And we've talked about that fabricated lie story. And of course, the defeat of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda being the very group that the U.S. basically created themselves, and the Taliban being the group was the point in the beginning. Who they were trying to attack. That was all the big boogeyman in the beginning, if we all remember, was the Taliban. Yet a peace treaty is currently being negotiated with the Taliban themselves. I'll let you factor that one out for yourself. Now, and interestingly, as we continue to point out, Al-Qaeda being the group that the U.S. and the Hadi government are working in tandem with in Yemen, as well as they're supporting Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in Idlib in Syria, which is also an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. All over the place. Now, Congress never actually authorized the war in Syria at all, or any of them for that matter, but Syria specifically, dodging that obligation repeatedly because of political concerns. Now, Senator Bernie Sanders, who I will not advocate for because of many things that make me very... There's many things about his wishy-washy nature that make me uncomfortable. Maduro's a really, really bad guy, but we shouldn't do this, which, just have some guts and go after it. say that this is not right. That's my opinion. That's one example of many. But the point is that Bernie Sanders was one who said he was deeply critical of the resolution, saying that Congress should be ending military interventions, not coming up with more reasons to continue them. And I agree with that. And this is what we're talking about. That Congress, of course, seems to not care or bat an eye when Trump or any other president before him just initiates a new war, saying, oh, well, we're fighting some ambiguous idea of terrorism, so it's okay. And they don't even say anything. But now when they finally want to stop a war, oh my God, we have to jump into action. Congress can't let wars end these days. And this is exactly what Partisan Girl put out in a recent tweet. It says the U.S. Senate passes measure demanding Trump keep troops in Syria and continue the war forever. So a U.S. president can unilaterally start a war without state permission or Senate permission, but if he wants to end one, the Senate is going to get involved. Funny how that works. Now, I saw some really obnoxious responses to this. She's very clearly not saying that it's going to happen. It's a non-binding resolution, which I'm sure she knows. The point she's making is basically that the absurdity of them only getting involved when it comes to ending wars. It's something we really need to recognize that happens over and over. Now, for the final story of the day that I think is a really big deal, really makes me sad to see that this is continuing to happen. And all of this stuff, including Yemen, is just kind of getting overlooked these days because of these larger discussions, which are incredibly important. But I almost think intentionally, I'm pretty sure I would say, that Israel uses these big events to take moves that would otherwise carry much more outrage by the average people. They know that most people might not see it, so they do it under the guise of larger things. This article from Mint Press News, latest land grab, largest land grab since 1948. Israel to expel 36,000 Palestinians from Negev, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Very, very sad to see that this kind of thing is happening. And of course, the UN seems to kind of like speak out and say, oh, very bad. And oh, they're ethnic cleansing. And oh, look, they're trying to do this. And they're going to annex the entire country. You know, all they keep saying these things and nothing happens. Largely because of their support from the United States. Now, the Israeli government has completed work on a massive, far-reaching plan that would expel an estimated 36,000 Palestinians from what they call unrecognized villages. And its implementation could begin as soon as this year. And would take apparently about 4 years to complete. Now, the plan, compiled by Yuri Ariel, Israel's Minister of Agriculture and Rural Development, and of course, one of Israel's government, Israel's government's top proponents, excuse me, I'm hacking that statement for some reason, the Israeli government's top proponents of ethnic cleansing of Palestinian inhabited territories. It's funny, but the thing they pretend is not really happening, right? But he's an open proponent for ethnic cleansing. Interesting. Now, the plan features the seizure of an estimated 64,247 acres from the Palestinians. Now, the plan is being called, as I said, the largest land grab of Palestinian inhabited land since 1948. You know, when the state of Israel established itself on an illegally occupied Palestinian land. Now, according to the new plan, the Palestinian villages would be demolished. And the ruins of their homes would then become the sites of national projects, infrastructure projects, and security installations. Or, of course, after forcibly transferring, they say it, forcefully transferring the land's current inhabitants to other state-approved settlements. And we've seen how well that's worked out so far. Now, as it's noted, that a major motivation behind the plan's creation was the transfer of an arms industry factory from another part of Israel. So they just simply want to change locations and they're willing to just displace all of these people to do it, as well as the expansion of the Trans-Israel Highway system. Now, furthermore, the plan involves calling for a budget increase to boost the presence of law enforcement officials involved in the forcible transfer and, of course, the demolition of the Palestinian villages, because we need all these people on hand to forcefully remove Palestinians from their own land again. Now, Sarah Lee Whiteson, executive director of the Human Rights Watch, the Middle East and North Africa division, stated, the forceful eviction of Palestinian residents to make way for a new Jewish town would be a blatant an ugly episode of discrimination mirroring Israel's unlawful settlements. Long after most of the rest of the world has such rejected racist policies, the Israeli government keeps building and raising communities on the basis of religion and ethnicity. And guess what? That was said in 2016. And it's still happening. Good thing the Human Rights Watch and all these different groups are actually affecting any real change in these areas. But it's good to see that she's saying something about it. And people continue to talk about it. This is an inherently racist policy based on who these people are. I mean, just think if this was happening in this country, people would flip out. But why is it okay for Israel to do it? Now, these Palestinian villages have long been, as they say, unrecognized by the state of Israel, which has claimed that Palestinians in these areas cannot prove their ownership or claim to the land. This has been used to justify the withholding of basic services such as running water and electricity. These people, even under Israelis' rule in their mind, technically being on Israel, as far as they see it, are not even considered Israeli citizens. They don't even have addresses. And this is not because they haven't been there for a very long time. It's because Israel has had them in their sights to remove these people for the projects they're talking about. They refuse to give them the recognition, not because they haven't sought it. Very important point. Now, as a consequence of the lack of formal recognition, remember that they refuse to give them so that they can do this and then point to that unrecognized area as if that's why they're doing it, despite the fact that they have yet to refuse to give it to them. But a consequence of their lack of formal recognition, Israel authorities do not regard the Palestinian inhabitants of these villages as having any rights to the land whatsoever, even though many of the villages were established several decades ago by Palestinians forced from their homes following the illegitimate creation of the Israeli state in 1948. So basically, they kicked them out of their homes, said, you guys can't live here anymore. We're taking your land. They set up somewhere else after they were illegally removed. And now they're saying, well, you don't have a right to that land because you're unrecognized in your second area. So they're kicking them out again. It's disgusting. It's nefarious. They clearly think, as we pointed out before, that these people are less than human. Now, given the state's rejection of their existence, Israeli government officials have called the Palestinians living in these villages as violators or squatters, accusing them of illegally occupying state lands. Now, if that's not the pot calling the kettle black, I've never seen a better example. Illegally occupying state lands. As a result, these villages have constantly been under threat of demolition, with the Israeli government even forcing the inhabitants of demolished villages to actually pay for the destruction of their own homes. Think about that. They kick you off your land, you build a new home. They come in and say, well, you're not allowed to be there either, and we're going to build a military installation there, so you have to pay us to destroy your home and go find somewhere else to live. Or they're going to give them a different state-sanctioned settlement, which is basically a slum somewhere else in an open-air prison. This is what we're talking about today. It is disgusting that this is happening. It's also disgusting that it's being backed by the United States. By non-action or the $38 billion being sent to them every year, which is what they're currently trying to pass. Now, the newly announced plan is just a part of a wider Israeli government push to annex Palestinian territory and ethnically cleanse areas that have already been annexed by Israel. And this hopefully resonates with some people that back them for what, religious reasons, or just because you're told that they're an ally. We need to see, as I continue to point out, what's happening here in Israel, or rather Palestine, what's happening in Yemen with the U.S. backing the Saudis. These are their allies today. Now think about if this was happening in Venezuela, let's say. Just think of the overwhelming onslaught of negative reporting that would come from the mainstream media. Just really think about the contradictions here of all the stuff we talked about today. And hopefully you can find some kindness in your heart for people that just simply want to exist. They're trying to make good of their life that's already been destroyed by these people who have no concern for their well-being whatsoever. So hopefully we can see some change. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I love you all for being here, and hopefully you will spread this message and get it out there as we're seeing these, you know, apparently conspiracy videos being shut down all over the place, seeing independent voices being shut down all over the place. So it's on you to get this information out there, to spread it and share all the things we're talking about in every possible way you can. If you want to support this channel, there's numerous links in the show notes for you to do so, with cryptocurrency or whatever else, because I can't do this without you. I only exist because of you. You guys are the last American vagabond, and that's important to recognize, that we are doing this together. So again, I love you. Thank you so much. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.